On House Bill 2806. Jason, do you want to bring us up to speed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2806 vests authority to regulate indoor smoking in certain places licensed by OLCC exclusively in the legislative assembly. We have in front of us the House 5 proposed amendments. If I'll defer to Representative Deckert.
Representative Deckert?
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2806.
Representative Deckert moves the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2806.
Chairman?
Representative Montgomery?
Dash 5 amendments, is that the one that eliminates city from this Corvallis?
Correct.
Mr. Chairman, as a courtesy, I'll go ahead and support this, but that's awful. We have this bill before us because of Corvallis, and we're eliminating it. So I think that's wrong, but I'm all supportive.
Further discussion? Representative Cummins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really support the bill. I'm going to give the bill a courtesy vote out so that the debate can be had on the floor whether or not it's good public policy. But from my own perspective and my own standpoint, I really don't support it.
Any further discussion? Hearing seen none? Okay. Want to call the roll?
Representative Denver?
Aye.
No.
Trammell?
Aye.
Montgomery?
Aye.
Rasmussen?
No.
Rosenbaum?
No.
Hammond?
Aye.
Witt?
No.
Cherry
Hill? Aye. Dash 5 amendments are adopted. Representative Deckert?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2806 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Deckert moves House Bill 2806 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I noticed that there seems to be a great deal of courtesy here among the committee. It's a courtesy that frustrates me very much so, because I wonder where the courtesy is to individual city leadership and individual voters and communities that wish to make the decisions for themselves in their own local communities. And while we're all having a fine and courteous time this afternoon, I'm left wondering where's the courtesy to our citizens and to our voters. I will be opposing this bill.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I am opposed to this bill, too. I really still think we ought to hear some testimony about what would cause the state of Oregon to wade into an area and preempt local jurisdictions. There was no testimony in our initial hearing that indicated why in this particular area it would be difficult to implement local ordinances. I think that there are compelling arguments about the safety of the people that work in these establishments. I had occasion Saturday night, I don't spend a lot of time in bars, but did find myself in a rainstorm and went into an establishment, very nice one, asked if they had a non-smoking section, was directed to three tables that were basically adjacent to the bar, and my choice, and I don't think this is just an issue for people that work there, my choice was to go back out on the street or to stay, and there were very few people smoking in this particular bar, and yet the entire place was smoky. So I think this is an issue where we should not be wading in, that local jurisdictions like Corvallis and others, I think, who will soon want to follow suit, have the absolute right to do that. The state of California, our neighbor, which is not known as being really radical on these issues, has managed to live with a similar law. We haven't found that they have no bars in California, and I think that this is really a shame for us to be taking this step today. I guess if it needs to be debated on the floor, then that's where it will end up. And I think that this is really an outrageous action for us to be taking.
Any further discussion? Hearing seen none, please call the roll.
Representative Decker?
Aye.
Kane?
No.
Trammell?
Aye.
Montgomery?
Courtesy, aye.
No.
No.
Aye.
Witt?
No.
Cherry Hill?
Aye. House Bill 2806 moves to the floor.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
I would like to serve notice of a possible minority report.
I'm with her.
Okay, notice of a possible minor report has been served. Close the work session on House Bill 2806. Representative Deckard will carry the bill.
You ready to say a few introductory remarks?
I'll talk about the bill summary and I think Gary will adequately cover each provision.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1149. Jason, would you please give us a brief overview on the bill? By the way, for today's purposes, we have invited testimony, and the purpose of the invited testimony is to overview the bill. It's not to come and provide lots of arguments for or against the bill or to offer amendments. We realize it's going to take some time to get through this bill. We realize there's a number of people who want to give input on this bill and who want to offer some amendments to this bill. There will be time for all of that. Today, what we'd like to do, since this is a fairly complex matter, we want to give members of this committee an opportunity to come up to speed on this bill, to get some basic information on the bill, and, of course, to ask questions that they have on the bill as that information is provided. So, if you're not part of the invited testimony today, don't feel in any way left out. You will have every opportunity to weigh in on this bill, to offer your input, and also to offer amendments on the bill. So please be patient with us as we get through this process. It's going to take some time, I think, for us to get through this bill and give committee members a fair opportunity to understand the bill. Representative Montgomery?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we planning to go through this section by section? The reason my question is, I understand there's all kinds of amendments coming forward, and to review the bill is going to be completely changed. My question is, what's the intent of the chair?
Yeah, Representative Montgomery, I think the characterization completely changed is not accurate. I think there will be a recognition that there will likely need to be some amendments to this bill, but it's my hope that this bill will survive largely intact as it is, with some judicious and responsible and reasonable amendments. I think what we want to do today is get a good understanding of the bill as it currently is currently constituted, as it was voted on in the Senate and comes to us in the House today. So, if there's no other questions at this point, Jason, go ahead and give us a brief overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1149 provides Oregon commercial electricity consumers direct access to competitive electricity markets not later than October 1, 2001. It adopts transition policies for competitive electricity markets. It adopts retail electricity consumer protections. It permits certain electric utilities to elect exemption from direct access requirements of the Act. It establishes public purpose expenditure standards funded by a public purpose charge. It allows local governments to levy privilege tax for use of public streets, alleys, or highways, and declares an emergency effective on passage. Committee's benefit, we will not be doing a section-by-section analysis, but Gary Conklin and Jason Ice, who worked on the coming to agreement on major portions of the bill, will take us through the important parts of the bill.
Okay. Any questions at this point? If not, Mr. Conklin and Jason, if you'd come forward, please. Give a message if you're invited to testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling, here today representing the Oregon Energy Coalition, which is a group of industrial and commercial end users who have been working on the issue of electricity restructuring in Oregon for more than 3 years. Jason Eisdorfer is joining me today for purposes of this panel, and what we have put together at the chair and staff suggestion is a presentation that attempts to try to give you an overview of the bill and some of its features, how it might work, and what at least some of the expected benefits might be. We provided you with a copy of the overview. And Jason and I are going to try to to go through this with a little bit of choreography. If we can remember our parts, we'll give you the right parts, but we've worked on this enough that we can give each other's parts fairly well. The presentation specifically, we'll try to first identify who supports the bill, what the features are, again, its applications, and the benefits. And if we may just give a brief bit of background, electricity restructuring is something that has been underway for some time. It is not really something that is new. In fact, there has been competition at the wholesale level in electricity sales since the early part of this decade. Utilities themselves are in a rapid state of change through acquisitions, sales of generation or distribution assets, as well as the formation of competitive affiliates. Another point that's probably worth making is that Oregon, by virtue of consideration of this act, isn't itself at the cutting edge. Now states throughout the United States representing almost 50% of the population of the country either have or are embarking on competitive strategies on their own.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jason Weisdorfer. I'm an attorney with the Citizens Utility Board, which is one of 117 members of Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, which is primarily non-profit interest, conservation, renewable energy, low-income seniors, consumer groups, some small businesses, and a couple of utilities are members of Fair and Clean. In finishing off the background, as you are all aware, Oregon has low rates as it is. On average, it has the fourth lowest rates in the country, and it's fair to say that the reason for that is the presence of very low cost hydroelectric power, both on the federal system and the utilities in the region also own some very low cost resources. The access to Bonneville is had by the community-owned utilities throughout their entire customer class. For the investor-owned utilities, the residential customers have access to Bonneville power through federal law. Commercial and industrial customers of those utilities don't have that access. In terms of 1149 supporters, the crux of the support is the customers, the industrial and the residential customers support the bill. The consumer advocates support it, but utilities support this as well. PGE is supporting it, EWEB. Some of the potential marketers, PG&E, are supporting it, and the community-owned utilities are neutral at this point. Additional support comes from renewable energy advocates, conservation and consumer groups. Organized labor has supported it, which is very important to us as well, and senior groups also. What we're going to do is, on this slide, is to discuss the basics of it, and then the remainder of the presentation will be a more detailed explanation of it. The bill provides for direct access for large customers, industrial and commercial customers.
Representative Thomas.
Thank you. I noticed, Jason, that you have given us a list of supporters. Who's against it?
I'm not sure I can speak for them right now, and I'm sure you'll hear from those who aren't in favor of it. I'm not. They haven't directed me to make public if they are for or against it. So,
yeah, maybe I can respond to that, Representative. There are a number of organizations and folks that are going to come forward over the course of the next 7 to 10 days or so that are going to have specific recommendations relative to amendments to this bill. I'm aware of four or five such groups. What we really want to do today is we want to look at the bill as it passed the Senate, and those folks have all been assured they'll have plenty of opportunity to bring forth their specific concerns within the context of trying to amend the bill to address those concerns, not to kill the bill.
Residential customers under the bill would get a portfolio of options, including a rate that looked very much like the rate that we're receiving today, plus some additional choices such as a green rate and a market rate. Distribution and transmission services would stay regulated. This is really the deregulation part of this is on the generation side. And finally, access to Bonneville Power is a mainstay of this. Access to Bonneville Power is maintained in this bill.
Again, for your tape purposes, I'm Gary Conkling with the Oregon Energy Coalition. This bill is a bill that is designed to provide a measured step towards competition. As Jason indicated, it provides direct access for those customers that have the technical capability and the willingness to assume risk that's associated with going to the market, and would provide that access in October of 2001. It also provides essentially a protected market for residential consumers with an evaluation by the PUC as to whether or not there would be benefits for the customer class of having some form of competition, and if so, when and under what conditions. The bill contains provisions relating to market structure that are intended to make sure that, in fact, what is generated is a competitive market. It talks of balanced interests between consumers as well as utilities, and it provides tools for customer-owned utilities, which are not mandated to provide direct access, but it does provide for them tools that, if they choose to enter into a competitive environment, that they can do so. And it recognizes the value of the federal hydroelectric system. Now, the main features of the bill, we've indicated what our approach will be here is we'll walk through each of these and reference the sections in the bill where these features are contained. Market access for large customers is one of the main features. The portfolio model for residential customers, which in and of itself is a very unique concept. There is a 3% public benefits charge, as well as provisions for low-income heating assistance. There are provisions that relate to competitive market structure. For certain public utility commission authorities, including the determination of transition charges, both what they are and how they would be collected, consumer protections, and provisions relating to local control for customer-owned utilities. There also are a set of safeguards that Jason will mention.
Mr. Chairman, we think that this is structurally one of the best bills in the country for small consumers, and important in the bill for us is a provision that would delay or suspend direct access for all customers. If direct access were to jeopardize access to Bonneville Power for the residential customer class. Today, Bonneville Power Administration published rules and interpretation of federal law in the Federal Register that would apply to how Bonneville contracts would work with direct access. Those are out for a period of time in public comment. That issue of whether direct access in a state, how that works with access to Bonneville is an issue that it's going to take some time to work out. And it was our position that until we know that that access is secure, it's very difficult for the state to move forward and say that this is providing benefits for all. In addition, the Public Utility Commission continues, as I said earlier, to regulate the distribution systems. FERC will continue to regulate transmission. And then finally, the local board of the community-owned utilities will retain their authorities.
Even though the check mark isn't there, one of the other safeguards are provisions that relate to cities being able to convert their franchise fees to a different methodology so that they are held harmless through the process of direct access. It's also an important negotiated safeguard in the bill. The direct access provisions are referenced from the beginning in Section 2. They essentially apply directly to industrial and commercial customers served by investor-owned utilities, with the exception of Idaho Power, which has a relatively small group of customers in this state, but they would apply to both the customers of PGE and PacifiCorp. The bill talks of this access occurring no later than October 2001. There are some discretionary abilities for small commercial customers to retain a cost-based rate structure, much like they would have today. And as a function of direct access, utilities would unbundle their costs for power generation, transmission, distribution, and retail services. Again, in terms of how this might work, what you might have, for example, is an owner of a large building, such as the one depicted, that would actually entertain and receive offers from different energy service providers. And that offer could relate to price of the commodity of energy. It could also have factors relating to reliability. This is particularly important to, for example, a large computer chip manufacturer. The quality of the power is an essential ingredient. And it might also relate to innovative services that could range anywhere from time-of-day service to specialized kinds of activity. For example, a hospital might be interested in having some kind of a switch so that it could take advantage of its already required backup power to use it at certain times to shave peak loads and therefore be able to buy power at a lower, flatter rate. It might also work for a restaurant or a bakery that has a lot of off-hour uses that they might be interested in taking advantage of off-peak times. These are just examples of the kinds of things that when you hear people talk about direct access, but what they talk about is a marketplace that will have more than just low prices or lower prices, but can have these services as well. The bill provides for certification of these energy service providers. These are the people who actually will go out and purchase the power resources to serve the loads that they contract for. So in a sense, you have people who are organizing loads by market as opposed to just territories. The customers are going to get their bill from the energy service provider, but the electricity itself, in all likelihood, is going to flow pretty much like it does today. The advantages for businesses, they're going to be better able to match their electricity service options with their needs. I believe they can save money, and they can also work directly with their suppliers as strategic partners.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to describe the portfolio. Rather than going with direct access for residential customers, we have been advocating a portfolio of options, and the reasons I think it's appropriate to give you the reasons why we are not advocating direct access for residential customers at this time is that the market, looking around at other states that have restructured, the market simply is not ready. for residential customers, and we don't think that residential customers are particularly ready for the market either. Individually, we don't have market power. We don't have the sophistication to take advantage of benefits like industrial and commercial customers, and there is a risk of discriminatory service. In addition to that, it's still not clear in that direct access is compatible with Bonneville Power. So that what we what came out of the UE 102 process, which was PGE's application of restructure before the Public Utility Commission, was something called the portfolio access model for residential customers, which is a low-risk offering of a limited number of options. It would be available in October 2001, and it gives residential and small customers a cross-base rate, which again is very much similar to what it would be very similar to our present rate. Environmentally friendly or green power option and a market-based rate that could fluctuate. If you didn't choose any of those rates, you would default to the cost-based rate. Probably wouldn't even notice that there was a difference in the structure.
Excuse me, Jason. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the issue in terms of residential choice in terms of PGE's UE 102 expressions of the commission, PGE in this past interim did a pilot project in terms of where residential customers were given choice in terms of, and depending upon who you talk to, either they thought it was great success, but in terms of, are we to take in terms of with it going to this portfolio model, that it wasn't successful, and that was what the commission learned out of it? I mean, is it?
Mr. Chairman, I can't say for the Public Utility Commission what they learned. I was on the task force that oversaw the results of that, the PGE pilot. I didn't believe that the results that we were seeing price-wise certainly were going to be, that they were realistic, that those were the kinds of things we could expect in the real market. I think it was there were some artificial elements to the pilot, which I think, again, this is my opinion, increased the amount of customers who went for those options, which, again, were artificially reduced. Pacific Corp also has done a pilot in this state, and it is the portfolio pilot. And they have, I think, they are pretty happy with the results there. They've offered a cost of service rate, environmentally friendly rate, and a market rate. And people seem to like to be able to move around. So we actually have examples of both kinds in terms of pilots in this state.
Mr. Chair, if I might just append to that, I think that the distinction, the draw between the PGE and Pacific Corp pilots is that the PGE pilot was, in fact, a pilot to have direct access for residential customers. They could choose any of the people that came to provide. There were not an abundant number of suppliers for the residential class, but there were, at least initially, some choices. So I think the difference here is that the portfolio is more like, as Jason indicated, the Pacific Corp pilot, where the utility itself offered the choices within its own input.
Mr. Chairman, to continue, in terms of how the portfolio works, again, Pacific Corp has experience with this. They mailed out a ballot with the three or four options in that pilot, side by side with each other, so you could compare what the content of each electricity service was. It compared the prices. It was easy to choose, and you could send back your ballot. If you don't do anything, if you don't send your ballot back, you will be served very much the way you're being served today. The billing and the rate system will stay the same, yet there will be a couple of additional choices for you to make, have the opportunity to make. And in the benefits of this this particular methodology is that there is security in the current system for most residential customers. They're really, in our office, they're not really banging on the door for direct access. The PUC will continue to have some regulatory authority over the rates. Those who do want a choice and direct their money toward environmentally friendly power will have the opportunity to do that. The portfolio is really designed to keep the residential utility customers aggregated to give us market power to go into the wholesale market and take advantage of wholesale competition without retail marketing costs. And then finally, it does maintain, it's a structure that does maintain access to Bonneville Power Administration power. The public benefits charge is a 3% charge on total energy services. It's tied to the date of direct access. It replaces the method of investing in public purposes currently in rates. Now, this is a very important point. In other words, these programs, conservation, renewable energy resources, and low-income weatherization, have been funded historically with ratepayer dollars. In fact, we're paying for these programs right now in our electricity rates. Investments in these three public purposes have decreased the last 3 or 4 years due to uncertainty as to what the market is going to do. This bill creates certainty. It creates what the market is going to look like, and the bill in turn creates the public purpose certainty in the public purposes funding.
Jason, is it fair to say that this 3% charge makes explicit what has been really implicit in rates here to date?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, that's exactly what we're saying. And it was not too many years ago, like 3 or 4 years ago, when all utility customers were actually paying more than 3% for these programs. What this does is find the right level to start funding it at, a consistent level, and then people know what they're paying and what they're getting out of the system.
Mr. Chair. Representative King, I'm wondering why lower cost or potentially lower cost technologies or sources wouldn't be listed as a potential public benefit. Or are you feeling that's just left to the market? But I'm seeing that it could be that those kind of technologies might require a temporary subsidy in order to reach critical mass. So I'm wondering why lower cost would be left off the list of investment options.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, I think you're hitting on it. If they're ultimately lower cost, the market will favor those technologies. These public purposes here may cost more upfront, but in the long conservation, for example, may cost more upfront, but in the long term is a least cost resource. It's getting over that initial hump. I think some of the low cost resources, technologies you may be talking about, as they come into the market, will not have a problem finding purchases.
Well, but I think that I'm trying to reach over this microphone here that lower cost might require, you know, a period of, let's say, 10 years, for example, to reach a critical mass before it could be, you know, competitive and survive in a competitive market. And that it wouldn't necessarily be treated as conservation, it wouldn't be renewable, and it wouldn't be weatherization. So a public purpose of a potential technology that could eventually have lower costs would seem like a legitimate public purpose.
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, I guess the issue is whether that technology finds a market, a barrier to the market. And I think ultimately, if it is a low-cost, lower-cost technology, those barriers really won't be in there. Every technology needs a lead-in time for investment. The question is, are there barriers to market entry for those products? And if ultimately that product is going to be favored because it's low cost, there really isn't much of a market barrier. But that's the concept, I think, that's in the public purpose of charge.
I think I disagree a bit. So much. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, how it will work through long years of discussion with various parties, it's the money has been directed into a number of pots. 68% goes to new cost-effective conservation and market transformation. 19% goes to new above-market renewable energy costs, and 13% goes for low-income weatherization. There are a number of credits that large customers can take advantage of in terms of the public purposes. If they invest in their own plants, they're credited against the 3%, and the 3% charge continues for 10 years. Ultimately, the benefits of the public purposes is that the spending goes to conservation and renewable energy resources, which has environmental impacts as well, something that I'm not necessarily sure the low-cost technologies might have. Conservation both reduces the ratepayers' rates, but also reduces the impact on the energy system because we use less, and renewables add diversity to the generating systems, and diversity is something we may very well need as we move toward a natural gas heavy market. Finally, on the public purposes related to it, this bill would also begin a low-income heating assistance program, which would also begin in January of 2001. The PUC, by rule, would determine how much of the money would go into the how it would go into rates. The money goes to people and families facing difficulties in paying their bill and in imminent service cutoffs, and no customer will pay more than $500 per site. The federal energy assistance has been, it's a fraction of what it used to be. The need is not going away, but the money at the federal level is going away, so this is an attempt to put some, you know, firm that up a little bit.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Mr. Eisdorfer, on that, a couple of slides ago, there was a little block that you didn't talk about under how it will work that says 80% spent in service territory utility collect fees. What does that mean, and where does the other 20% get directed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, what that means is that people paying into the public purposes charge will be assured that the vast majority of that money is coming back to the territory where they live. There is a portion, 20%, which would essentially go to the areas where the need is greatest. So there's a trade-off between making sure that those who spend the money also make sure that the money comes back to their territory, but also where some needs are not being met, there is some flexibility in allowing that money to be spent on those uses.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Does it still required to be spent in our state, or not even necessarily here?
Oh, yes.
Just not in that particular...
That utility territory.
Now we'll turn to the section dealing with market structure, which is Section 5. I won't try to go over this in any particular level of detail. As I noted before, there are requirements that relate to unbundling services prior to direct access. The PUC is to develop policies to eliminate barriers to a competitive retail market. In other words, there is affirmative language that's what are to be the outcome of policies. And utilities will be required to act as ESPs through affiliates. It's just an example of ways to try to prevent, in this new competitive market, cross-subsidies. And this happens to be my favorite picture. I don't know if you like it or not, but... It made me feel good when I put it in here. The notion is to avoid a market strength or a concentration of market strength so that, in fact, you will allow new competitors to move into the market, and they may come from surprising sources, like most markets operate. people with innovative ideas may be there. There are also, in the bill, are provisions relating for asset divestiture. Again, the idea is to attempt to create structures that are as competitive as possible. The bill makes clear that there is a non-discriminatory access to distribution systems for ESPs, so no one would be prevented from essentially using systems, and that there are reciprocity provisions, so that if a utility chooses to be an ESP, that will require them to open their own territory to competition. So we believe that what this bill will produce is, in fact, a competitive marketplace that will evolve. It won't, from day one, as Jason has indicated, necessarily be robust for everyone, but it probably, almost the day it opens, will be relatively active and robust for industrial and many commercial customers, as well as also making sure that there is a place in the marketplace for new and innovative competitors.
Chairman, as you can guess, there are the details of implementing this be very complicated, very technical. It requires a high degree of specificity. What the bill does is not try to answer every question. It directs the PUC to go through a series of processes, which will be conducted in a public process. And we'll get input from utilities, customers, competitors, and the public interest. And among the things that the PUC is directed to determine is, first of all, it prevents unwarranted cost shifting caused by direct access. It determines transition charges and benefits and how to collect or remit them. It continues to regulate the distribution system, certifies energy service providers, and creates the rules for unbundling, which is the splitting out of your bill of distribution, transmission, and generation services, and also rules for aggregation. The bill directs the PUC to begin a rulemaking process. It's similar to the UE 102 process that I mentioned a little bit earlier. And it clearly gives the PUC some direction in what it needs to do and how it finds. There is a checkpoint, if needed, at the 2001 legislature before direct access commences.
Sure. Representative Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Eisenberg, in terms of the rationale behind giving so much authority, instead of doing it statutorily in terms of some of the decisions, what was the rationale for giving the PUC are moving some of the decision-making and some of the choices away and allowing the PUC to do it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Deckard, I think one major rationale is our experience in UE 102 took about a year to figure out a lot of the details. I don't know that you want to see us here for a year. At some point, the technical issues have got to be moved out of the legislature. If the legislature on a policy basis gives the PUC a framework on which to operate, there's just too many details and very complicated issues, and it would be simply too time-consuming for this legislature to try to answer all of those. And on another track, if we were to try to sit down now and answer all those questions, I don't know that we could ever get a bill. We need to get the policy framework and then give the PUC the authority and the direction to go and make the technical and detailed rules that can allow us to move forward.
Now, is this a picture of negotiating with the PUC?
That's me in the middle.
It's actually a picture of Jason negotiating with me.
I think I mentioned earlier that among the duties that the PUC will be assigned is how to separate generation, distribution, transmission services. And then sets rules for allowing direct access customers to aggregate and get market power as they go off into the market. Again, to sort of summarize, the intent of 1149 was not to be loaded down with detail. It was to give clear policy direction to the PUC and allow that process, which does get input from all of the interested parties. The rulemaking would come out of that process. So.
Consumer protection is an important element. Just reflecting back in the 1997 legislative session when we spent a great deal of time talking about details, this was, interestingly enough, one of the sections where actually fairly complete agreement on language was reached. But in keeping with the bill, it also is a relatively economic statement of the policy of consumer protection. It includes such things as certification of ESPs, including code of conduct, and verification of claims, such as for green power, to maintain safe, reliable distribution system, which is important to consumers, to require itemized bills for direct access customers, as well as a requirement for consolidated bills so that people don't sort of get a flood of paperwork. And may seem like sort of minor issues, but billing is in fact a very significant issue. And for any of you who've ever had a chance to talk about such things as metering, you'll discover more than you ever want to know about that subject once you start talking about it with people. So the idea is that ESPs, the energy service providers, are going to be required to back up their offers and verify claims, that you're going to have bills that are going to be fairly clear as to what you're paying for energy, for example, and what taxes or fees you might have, and what transition charges, if any, you are subject to. You're clearly going to have continued regulation of distribution systems. And I think that that's a point that can't be emphasized enough, that that part of the electricity world is not going to really change in any substantial way. At the end of the day, the goal is to have a fair marketplace, to maintain safe and reliable electricity service, through, in fact, distribution companies with their own profit and loss statement, so that, in fact, there's a real clear understanding of where dollars go to make sure that right-of-ways are clear, that repairs are made in reinvestment so that the system is, in fact, secure, and that bills for consumers are informative. One of the maybe longest debated, most people have lots of things to say about this provision, are those separate provisions in this bill that relate to customer-owned utilities. And as the head suggests, I think they best can be characterized as providing and preserving local control of these utilities that have really a unique even among themselves, they have relatively unique situations, but most notably, in fact, they have locally elected boards and have very different relationships with their customers than an investor-owned utility does. So what this bill does is essentially affirm that governing board authority to allow direct access, to determine transition charges, to allow the collection of BPA transition charges, and to determine ESP standards as well. The bill does provide significant tools, which representatives of the customer-owned utilities are better able than ourselves to describe in more detail. But I think it's fair to say for those customer-owned utilities, and we believe there will be some, that will in fact move to some level of competition, there are tools that permit them to do so for the protection of their larger customer interests. It also affirms their authority over their distribution system, metering, billing, and collection, all of which are important elements to them. In effect, what we're saying is that each customer-owned utility will be able to decide for itself about direct access, and they can decide it. I think this is a significant point on a customer class by class basis. Back provisions are made to permit them to do that. So it gives them some abilities that mirror the system that has been proposed in this bill for the investor-owned utility, which is direct access for certain customers and a portfolio model for others. They also are able to control the terms of direct access, and like others, the 3% public benefits charge would follow direct access by class, and it's subject to the same 10-year sunset.
Representative Hill?
So, as I understand it, then Senate Bill 1149 would, among companies that may be diverse around the state that compete in a single marketplace, one, because of a decision of this legislature, would be imposed a 3% public purpose charge, and a competitor of theirs, may be served by a customer-owned utility, would not have that same burden, for lack of a better term, and we could then, in certain circumstances, be influencing the ability and the competitiveness of companies.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, or Mr. Chairs, I guess, these are both the chairs. The answer I'd give to that is that today the current system of territories does not provide for absolute equity, either in rates or in lots of other areas. In fact, there is a symmetry in this bill that if a customer, either a commercial or an industrial customer, has access to the market, they would be subject to the 3% public benefits charge. The point you make is that there is not absolutely going to be direct access in all parts of the state, and that is true. But to the extent that people have the same access to a competitive market, they will be subject to the 3% public benefits charge.
And Gary, isn't it also true that for the great majority of businesses that will be subject to this 3% charge, that those charges have been implicit in their rates heretofore?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. In fact, that's one of the issues that our colleagues in the Fair and Clean Coalition and their constituents have argued, that today embedded in rates are imputed amounts of money that are to go for these purposes, but perhaps have not always been spent to the level of the rates that have been embedded. And what this bill basically does is to make a decision, a policy decision, to make the collection and expenditures of those monies more explicit for the purposes for which they have been intended.
Isn't it also true, Gary, that industrial customers who enter into a free market relative to the generation of power have the hope or the expectation that competition provides some price benefit? So if you're in a territory that where direct access is available, it may give you some competitive advantages over businesses that are in a territory where direct access is not available.
Mr. Chairman, there, in today's environment, the very same thing that you just said is true. If we were to have a longer conversation than perhaps is warranted at this meeting about variations of rates for industrial customers, even within the same utility territory, it probably would be quite surprising. So the reality is that what we anticipate is having a competitive market for the purchase of the commodity of energy. We think that's both going to have price benefits as well as service benefits. And we think ultimately it will benefit more broadly the economy to do it, not on necessarily a case-by-case basis, but essentially on a customer class basis, or in this case, a group of businesses throughout the state. Quickly, just to summarize, the advantage here is that essentially this bill concludes there's no one-size-fits-all strategy that works for all for all utilities in this state. This does permit customer-owned utilities to respond to their localized customer demands. and it gives customer-owned utilities the security that many of them have sought prior to them entering in some fashion to a competitive market.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry, Chairman Witt, I didn't realize we mixed it up on it. I get the last word here. If anyone tells you that this is without risk, they're not telling you the truth. But there are also risks in doing nothing. And we also need to be aware that the times are changing, and we need to change with them. We don't need to do what everyone else is doing, and the Oregon is a special case, and I think that this bill is tailored well for Oregon and Oregonians. And key to that is the ability of the PUC to determine by a particular date whether or not direct access for any customer affects potential access to Bonneville Power, which by all accounts at this point is still the best deal as far as you can see. The PUC, as part of the cost of service rate, may require a utility to purchase from Bonneville Power under Bonneville Power's subscription process. The utility is held harmless from any risk and gets no benefit from those contracts. The cities continue to get...
On the issue in terms of the PUC, do they have that authority today?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, it's not clear. My best guess is that the commission could lean on the utilities and could provide some disincentives that they did.
Let me help you.
Okay.
The answer is no.
Right.
They can negotiate with the utilities to that end,
right,
but they do not have the authority to require.
That's right. Thank you for the help. Where I come from, sometimes when the PUC leans, it means something. The cities may switch to, are switching to, changing the way they collect the franchise fees, but it continues to collect it so that they're not harmed. And then existing contracts for the community-owned utilities are protected in the bill. So, again, in summary, it's not without risk, but it's a good bill for Oregonians. It reduces those risks. There are a number of safeguards. It provides benefits, we think, to the industrial and commercial customers in the form of direct access.
Thank you. Are there any questions at this point?
I'm sure there will be, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'm sure they'll be around, so thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for your testimony. Commissioner Aiken? By the way, very colorful presentation. We appreciate that. Well put together.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ron Ekus. I'm chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I'm sorry I don't have a fancy computer presentation to give you. We're just a poor little state agency. So,
I've seen a lot.
Actually, this is kind of a relief because usually in past sessions I've started off and people in the back here have heard time and time again various presentations and overviews of direct access and restructuring. This time the two people before me gave a very good overview, I think, not only of the issue but of the bill. I don't have any real prepared testimony. I'm here to answer questions. We have participated in the construction of this bill. From our point of view, the bill is workable. It contains timelines within which we can work. The bill provides the safeguards that we think were necessary in order to do a couple of things. Assure that ratepayers, residential ratepayers, were not harmed. and assure that there were sufficient safeguards, that the low-cost resources for the state of Oregon were not going to be lost, and it provides sufficient authority to develop rules for both consumer protection and market protection. In many cases, the Public Utility Commission has become, in some ways, its own default supplier for this issue. Many issues are defaulted to us, either because they are very technical, involved issues, and our process allows the resolution and addressing of those issues by all of the interested parties, or because it is difficult to reach agreement among the parties or the legislature on specific directions, and the Public Utility Commission becomes the place for the development of those issues and the resolution of those issues. Low-income assistance is one. It's an issue in which we've never done before, but it is one under this bill which is given to us in our process to resolve the specifics of that. I might address a couple of the issues in which previous questions were raised. As far as the pilot projects go, pilot projects were successful within the limited purpose with which we gave them. I do not believe you can look at the pilot projects and make any assessment or extrapolation from the pilot projects as to what would happen with direct access. But what the pilot projects did tell us is that there is interest, and it did tell us that there are no significant operational barriers to doing direct access. You've discussed public purposes to some extent. I've had staff go, well, I asked our staff to look back in the past as to public purposes, and we have, if you compare what was spent for conservation activities, energy efficiency activities with the amount that's in the public purposes, which for those purposes is about 2.43%, 96 and 97, and I assume 98, it is actually less, in 94 and 95 for both PG and Pacific Corps and PP&L, it was actually above that amount. 92 and 93 for Pacific, it was either close to or above that amount, and 93 for PG, it was about that amount. So,
is it the 3%?
I'm comparing only the energy efficiency expenditures with the 2.43% part of the 3% that is there. But I simply wanted to reinforce what was said before, is that these costs have been embedded in rates. Previously, they would be taken out and moved to the systems benefits charge. At times, it has been more. At times, it has been less public. This provides some, I think, some stability and assurance that this is, that the money is actually being spent. Another question that was raised was in relationship to BPA. Mr. Chairman, you asked the question. I think the answer is that currently we are not sure we have the authority to require them to purchase. We do have the authority to hold them accountable for not purchasing. Would be at the utility's risk. But I'm not sure that we could require them at this point. It certainly makes the process a lot more difficult if we have to, if the utility... if we have to go back and sort of make adjustments and make assumptions about what would have happened had the utility bought what we think they should have bought.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why aren't you sure?
Why aren't we sure that whether or not we have the authority? I think we would have to search the statute to find specific authority to make sure that we do. There may be statutes we could use that we could require them or have the effect of requiring them to purchase, but I think by and large we would be hesitant to do that. If you had to pick me, ask me to pick one or the other, I'd say no, we don't have the authority right now. We do have the ability. I think the current word of operation is intimidate. I think we have some ability to work with the utilities, but and if we think they should have purchased more BPA power than they did, and ratepayers would have benefited by that, we could adjust rates so that the ratepayers do not take that risk. However, that is an after-the-fact adjustment based upon some assumptions that one has to make. That becomes a much more difficult process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess this goes to my question of concern about this bill. This bill is wholesale expansion of authority to the Public Utilities Commission. And you just answered the previous question. You don't have the authority today, but you may have it in the future. And in the absence of a bill passing, which gives you the ability, I'm just curious how you would somehow, if today you don't have it, tomorrow you might have it.
Mr. Chairman, if we don't have it today, we won't have it in the future unless the legislature gives it to us.
Thank you. Because, Mr. Chair, I guess my concern is in terms of his trust. In the present PUC and the actions that you have taken in your regulatory authority in terms of with other utilities in the state, you've gone out on a campaign against them. And, you know, it comes back to the issue of credibility in terms of whether this legislature could trust vesting this much responsibility into the PUC.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would not agree with your characterization of what we have done. If we wanted to spend a lot of time talking about the Public Utility Commission's effort to hold U.S. West accountable to its past promises and and our service quality standards, we could do that. I think the best evidence of trust in the PUC is the fact that a large portion of the people who support this bill do so because it gives the PUC authority, and they have some confidence in our process and in our approach, as evidenced by the reaction you saw to the UE 102 decision.
If this UE 102 decision was a decision which you passed out and you didn't have the authority to enact, and so you went through a process and carved out how PGE could bring choice into their service district, but yet you didn't have the authority to do it, and so as part of UE 102 was a requirement to come to the legislature and ask for specific authority to be able to do that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we did that. We did introduce legislation. My point was that as far as I know, with our decision in UE 102, it was well received by all of the customer groups that participated in it, the industrial customers, the commercial customer representatives, the Citizens Utility Board, AARP. PGE did not outright reject it and said it was willing to work with it. We came to the legislature. We told people up front when we began the process that we believed in order to do what PGE was asking us, it was entirely likely that it would take additional legislative authority and that we would seek it to do whatever it was we decided. Everybody knew up front that there were things they were proposing and they were talking about in that proceeding which were going to require legislative action. We made the decision. I think it was well received by the people that participated in it, as far as I know. And I think it created some confidence in the approach that the PUC would take in relation to direct access. This bill is very consistent with, and I think in part is built upon the decisions that were made in UE 102. And I think people are turning to the PUC because they believe that is the proper place and that it is a place that can handle these issues and in which they will get a fair hearing and a fair opportunity to present their views, knowing full well that the Public Utility Commission may not agree with them. I think that's what you are hearing in the presentation of this bill.
Representative King?
Thank you. Just looking to ask, looking at a crystal ball, which I know is not easy. I'm looking for a best estimate. Maybe there is even some expertise that can be provided. What happens if Bongo Power goes to market rate to 1149 type B regs?
I'm sorry, Representative Thiel, I missed the last, or Mr. Chairman, Representative King, I missed the last part of your
if
question.
If Bonneville Power were to go to market rates versus the low rates we have, you know, for the north and west, then what would happen to 1149 E-RIT? You know, I saw in the previous, you know, testimony that there were, you know, is, you know, there was comment as to, you know, as long as BPA is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, if BPA was to go to market rates, I think there wouldn't be much benefit to BPA Power because it would be the same as the market to which anyone else has access to. There probably wouldn't be a need then for us to hold up direct access on the basis of not getting access to their low-cost power, because the assumption is that it, by saying it's low cost, is being offered at cost and not market. It would, it might have another effect of making it easier for people to compete for the residential market, because they wouldn't be competing against the low cost power, but the way we did UE 102, we made sure that all customers, regardless of energy service suppliers, had access to BPA power. So we tried to eliminate that barrier to competition. But I think the answer to your question is it would eliminate some of the concerns, but it would result in higher rates.
We would give you a new set of concerns, Representative Payne.
Yeah, just crystal ball looks a lot like mine. The 3% public purpose that's there for 10 years is, we find that that's there for 10 years because that seemed to be a, you know, a fair trade-off in incorporating this. Do we find that that's there because that's how long perhaps we anticipate reaching some equilibrium in the market, or is that there for 10 years because that's a reasonable sunset and needs to be reviewed then to see if there's, you know, continuing justification, you know, for public purpose?
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, I guess I'd lean toward the latter there, although there are elements of the first two involved. When it comes to public purposes, it's really, some extent, it is a trade-off. As Representative Witt was describing, there's the trade-off between paying the 3% and getting access to the market and the hope that the market will actually generate some price benefits that are overcome any short-term increases that may come from the 3%. I think you need to look at the purposes for which this is designed. And I think the 10 years does provide a number of things. It provides a reasonable sunset that's long enough that enables the money to work, that enables perhaps a more competitive market to develop for those programs, and it gives, I think the purpose of the 3% is to give some stability to the financing of these programs, to maintain, to make sure they are not going to be lost. In relation to your earlier question, these are basically things that have long-term benefits, but have short-term impact on prices. And we wanted to make sure that in a competitive market, often focused mostly on short-term price, that the long-term benefits were not lost. And within that context, I think 10 years provides both an assurance of funding, it provides some stability, and at the same time, it provides an opportunity for a more competitive market to develop, from which then you could decide either before that or after that, that the market is going to deliver it and you don't need the public purpose.
Representative Deckard, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron, my question is, and thank you for the testimony. In terms of, I spoke with a person that I respect on these issues, and their question to me was, Ryan, how are you going to handle the rate shock that residential customers might feel 6 months down the line after the passage? And that gave me pause. If you would walk us through how residential customers will be protected briefly, but walk us through how the residential customers will be protected.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Deckard, I don't think one can assume there will be rate shock and that this is designed to avoid that. We avoid it because the bill provides allows us to make sure there are no unwarranted cost shifts. It basically, the purpose of the cost of service offering is to make sure, as Mr. Conkling and Mr. Eisdorfer explained, to make sure that rates are basically similar to what they are now. If the issue comes up in the context, and I can give you a more extensive answer if you could tell me if the issue comes up in the context of an assumption of industrial customers subsidizing residential customers.
Mr. Chair, I mean, that was the thumbnail sketch of industrial customer goes down, does residential customer go up?
Okay, I'll try and be brief, Mr. Chairman, but I'll try and address it in that context if that's it. It is true, first, that in some cases, industrial customers are paying more than 100% of the cost that they impose on the system, and residential customers are paying less. We have recognized that for some time, and our current policy is to try and reduce that. We reduce it by times when we have a rate increase, more of the percentage of increase goes to residential customers than industrial. When we have a decrease, more of the decrease goes to industrial than it does to residential. Our current policy is to, over time, equalize the two without creating rate shock. This bill does not change, as far as I can tell, as far as I know, our ability to do that, because we are still offering a cost of service offering, and we are still regulating the distribution part, and we would still have the ability to take the same approach that we are taking now as far as the efforts to gradually bring that. Without the bill, we would still be bringing the two in equilibrium. We would still be doing it to avoid rate shock. With the bill, I think we're in the same situation because it does not take away any of our authority to do so as long as we're offering cost of service and we're regulating distribution.
So would it be fair to say, and this is somewhat of a crystal ball type question, but 5 years from now, that any rate increases that we are, at least in your estimation, any rate increases that a person might feel 5 years from now would be, they're inherent in the system that we currently have, and you're inherently going to feel them whether we go allow industrial goods to go to the market or not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Deckard, I think that in really general terms that's the intent of the bill and that's the authority that's there. What is going to raise rates is going to be the market. Or decisions by the utility. I mean, PacifiCorp right now has resources to serve its existing load. It doesn't have to go out into the market to do so. So the resources are there, and they would be at the cost. That's what the cost of service is designed to do. PG, on the other hand, is primarily already out in the market, so the rates in PG are probably going to be more affected by market fluctuations than perhaps PP&Ls, but it's already 60%, 60 to 70% market, so the rate would basically be the same basis for rates 5 years from now as it is now for residential customers.
In fact, Ron, it's possible as you project down the road here that as you create a more competition at the generating side of the industry, that you could have some long-term impact that will flow over to residentials that will create more market pressure and more market force to actually lower rates. Isn't that true?
Mr. Chairman, there is that possibility. That could happen in several ways. One, the market is opened up. There are more competitors. As I think Jason described, that the process we have is to allows wholesale competition benefits to get to retail customers. So to the extent that there are benefits to more competition in the wholesale market, those could get to residential customers. It could also happen in a way through the portfolio, depending on how the portfolio develops, because it's entirely possible that part of the portfolio options would not only be the cost-based, market-based power offered by the utility in a green power offering, but it could be market power, market-based or competitive-based rates offered by an energy service provider itself. The only difference is that you're not picking and choosing your energy service provider on a daily basis, or having the opportunity to do so. You may have a choice once or twice a year, but there's nothing that should preclude an energy service provider from being part of a portfolio offering. And on our UE 102, we contemplated that in UE 102, and I think we would contemplate that in our rules as a possibility. So it's possible that a residential customer could get the benefits of a competitive market through energy service providers as well. They just wouldn't have the constant risk or the constant churn that the other and commercial and industrial customers would have in having be able to choose direct access whenever they wanted. It's possible after 5 years that we could see that the market has in fact developed, or the potential interest in residential customers has developed to the point that you could allow direct access for residential customers, and I believe the bill anticipates that by requiring us to do the study, and so that if the legislature wished to, they could then open up the market.
Commissioner, there's been some concern that potentially Senate Bill 1149 grants too much authority to the PUC. Do you, in terms of looking at the bill, do you have any feelings that in any particular area there's an excessively broad grant of authority?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there are. I guess the answer is generally no. There is nothing in there except with us having to. The only thing that's different from what we would do now, or what we would expect to do or hope to do, is really we are now in the low-income assistance business where we were not before, but I think that's a matter of default. Most of what is in there is what we would expect to be in there. It's consistent with what we currently do. It is more than what we currently do in some ways, but that's because the very nature of actually restructuring, it's necessary to do that. And there are things in there which the legislature could easily decide, but which frankly, I think there's an expectation that it's difficult for the legislature to reach a consensus and make a decision that could hold a bill together. Stranded cost is an example. The legislature could just as easily make a determination of what stranded cost is. The legislature could make that determination, and I'm not sure it could sustain enough to get a bill passed and actually provide direct access. So we are, in a ways, by default, but it is nothing. There's nothing in there that, other than what we either had been doing or we would expect to do, otherwise expect to do, other than the low-income assistance.
And Commissioner, do you feel that the bill itself, in terms of the direction it gives the PUC, where it provides this grant of authority to the PUC, is the direction, in your opinion, sufficient for the PUC to be able to fulfill its responsibilities under the Act?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it is, yes.
Are there other questions for Commissioner Ekus? Anything else, Commissioner, you'd like to add at this point?
No, I don't think so, Mr. Chairman. As usual, we are here as a resource as well, and I know this is a very complicated issue, so I would invite any member who has questions that they would like to pursue outside of the hearing process to please feel free to contact us, and either I or my staff will try and provide you with the background and answers.
Will you be available for additional testimony as this evolves?
Unfortunately, I am gone most of next week. But our staff will be available for testimony. We do have some amendments we're suggesting, mostly technical by nature. Lee Sparling, who is here, will probably be the presenter of the amendments and also provide testimony if it's necessary or desirable.
Are you back the following week?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you for your testimony. See, Diane Cowan, I believe, is here from the Consumer Owned Utilities. Diane, why don't you come on up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Diane Cowan.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I just ask how late you're intending to go tonight?
Yeah, my hope is that we will be done by 5.
Thank you.
And I think we should be able to do that. Go ahead, Diane.
I don't expect to go longer than 22 minutes. You're right. For the record, I'm Diane Cowan, the Executive Director of the Oregon People Utility District Association, but I'm here today representing the consumer-owned utilities in Oregon. And we do appreciate the opportunity to be here today and discuss with you how we see community-owned utilities fitting in a restructured environment. As you know, there's 34 consumer-owned utilities. We serve approximately 25% of the state as far as consumers go, but we cover 75% of the geography of Oregon. The maps are being passed out, and it shows the dynamics of that. You'll see that we're located in the smaller cities, towns. We're in the rural areas, and we're also preference customers of Bonneville Power Administration. The important feature of our utilities is that we're all governed by locally elected boards of directors or city councils. We're concerned about the impact of restructuring on Oregon's small communities and the rural areas. We're concerned about losing the benefits of our low-cost hydro system in the Northwest. And because we already have the third lowest rates in the country, or some say the fourth, we're concerned about increased costs to our customers that may be created by restructuring. So what we did a year ago was we started got all of our members together and we started discussing these concerns. We addressed them by preparing amendments that were ready for any legislation that was considered by the Oregon legislature regarding restructuring of our industry. In order to preserve our existing rights of local control, we believe the legislature should consider two different paths to restructuring, one for the investor-owned utilities and one for the consumer-owned utilities. Mm-hmm. We found that in almost every state where restructuring has passed or is being considered, the consumer-owned utilities have been treated differently than investor-owned utilities. You're aware of the role of the PUC in regulating investor-owned utilities, and you've heard from Commissioner Ickes his comments on restructuring for the investor-owned utilities. Our consumer-owned utility local governing boards and councils play a very similar role in regulating consumer-owned utilities. I think it's very important to remember in the context of Senate Bill 1149, what this bill does is two separate paths, but it's paralleling the governing structure in our state that exists today. The main difference between our utilities, since they're not-for-profit, is that our boards and councils don't need to determine a rate of return for shareholders, as the PUC has to for the investor-owned utilities. But they do need to manage the cost of delivering electricity to their consumer owners, and the boards do allocate those costs among all their customers. Senate Bill 1149, Ann Gross, actually has three parts. One's for the investor-owned utilities, another for the consumer-owned utilities, and then the third, such as the definitions, the sections dealing with energy service suppliers, franchise fees, safety and reliability pertain to both the investor-owned utilities and the consumer-owned utilities. This structure clearly outlines the expectations and authorities of the PUC for the IOUs and the expectations and authorities by the consumer-owned utilities governing boards. I'll walk you through the bill a little bit to familiarize yourself with it. Sections 22 through 28 and 32 through 41 reflect all of our local control amendments, which we believe appropriately address the different structures of utilities in Oregon. As with most legislation, there's a need for amendments. We will be offering some at a later date, Mr. Chair. Section 22 is very important to us. It clearly declares the policy of the state of Oregon regarding consumer-owned utilities, recognizing the role they have played over the years and the rights and authorities of the utilities and their governing boards. Section 23, that sets out which portions of the bill do apply to us, which portions don't, and when some might. So that's the three different pieces I was talking about. Section 24 specifies that the governing boards are authorized to determine whether and under what conditions they will offer direct access. So that does allow them to open up for their entire system, open up just for a group, a class of customers, or to remain as they are today, what some would call the status quo. This section also contains our stranded cost language that Gary Conkling showed on the overhead, that where we could pass down any Bonneville stranded costs that come our way or any of those things. That's a very critical piece to this legislation. And then also there's language in there that authorizes the boards to add additional criteria to the certification standards for ESPs that serve in their service areas. And when somebody asks what that might, an example of that would be if perhaps a utility would like to make sure that the ESPs in their district are offering a certain amount of green power, and that's who they're soliciting in, they could add that as a specification. Section 25 speaks to net billing agreements. This is an arrangement made between several consumer-owned utilities and the Bonneville Power Administration for costs of certain nuclear power projects. This is often referred to as the EWEB amendment, although other utilities were also involved in those net billing agreements. The next section, 26, states our responsibility for our distribution systems, including meters, billing, and collections. And yes, if you wanted to spend a lot of time, we can dive into meters or any of those three. That's pretty hot issues. This language doesn't preclude us, though, from contracting with a third outside party if we'd like to have them handle that on our behalf, but we still remain responsible for those functions. Section 27 is the public purpose section for the COUs. That is very different than what is going on in the other section of the bill, but it does state our commitment to a non-bypassable public purpose charge for a period of 10 years from the date of access. Unlike the investor-owned utilities section, this section allows the boards to collect that fee on a class-by-class basis. That's an example. That would be if the industrial customers in one service territory were offered open access. They would be the only ones that the 3% would be collected from. So as a class receives open access, they contribute to that 3%. There's a provision in there for high-cost, low-density systems. When you serve the rural areas, it's not uncommon that you have a lot of line and few customers. And this allows a charge to be calculated on a volumetric basis rather than a gross revenue to whichever is less, to ensure that those already high-cost systems aren't unfairly penalized. It was also important and critical for us that the local boards be able to determine the program levels for their communities and that the funds would remain in the communities also. So unlike the investor-owned utilities section on public purpose, you won't find whether 68%, 14, or whatever, I don't recall the specific numbers, what has to go to conservation, low-income weatherization, et cetera. The boards are able to determine what's best for their community and also ensures that whatever they do collect stays in their service territory. This section, though, also includes our credits that would be taken into account when you calculate the total amount of that 3%. And consumers, companies that use more than one average megawatt of electricity at any one site, they'll be able to self-direct. Their program would be the same. This is the same language, basically, that's in the investor-owned utilities section of the bill. So what happens there are the light customers of the same size or 1 megawatt and above are all treated the same throughout the state on that issue, on credits. There's a few other sections in there, the 28 just, excuse me.
Representative King.
Thank you. Is it possible for large users to therefore not participate in the public purpose payment.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, if the serving distribution utility, let's say it's a co-op or a PUD or a muni, if they have not offered direct access for their large industrial customers, those large industrial customers would not be charged the 3%.
You say it again.
If a consumer-owned utility has not...
Investor-owned?
No, consumer-owned.
Okay.
If they have not offered direct access to that class of customers, then that class of customers, whether it be a large industrial, commercial, or residential, would not pay the 3%.
So if a large user shopped around and decided to purchase power from one of your customer owns, they purchased power from you versus from Bonneville Power, from one of your member organizations, then they would be participating in the public purpose?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative King, it would depend on the scenario that was available at the time. If one of our utilities was going to serve somebody outside their service territory, they will have had to open up their service territory for that class of customers, and so they would pay it at that time.
And so the only way that a large customer would not participate in public service then is if they bought power through their local customer-owned utility?
That's correct. That was not direct access.
So that would give them a 3% advantage potentially for staying within their customer-owned utility consumer base?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, that could be, that is accurate.
Yeah, I mean, I would point out, Representative King, you know, again, that I think as Commissioner Rica said, a high percentage of this 3% has already been imputed in the rates and it's included in the rates for customers of CIPCorp and the PGE presently. So to the extent that those costs already are in rates, if there's any competitive imbalance, and I don't know that there is, essentially already can.
Mr. Chair, the reason why I bring that concern up is that I think that, you know, some large consumers feel that, you know, they, if they do go buy direct, that they don't have any benefit from power that comes only from sources that are related to public, you know, to public purpose. And I think that public purpose is one of the things that in the long run does generate lower prices potentially and historically has, and that they do benefit. So I see how they work. And,
Section 28, if I continue, refers to the PUC territorial allocation statutes and simply states that nothing in this bill is altering or changing those. Section 29 is a franchise tax language, which is applicable to all utilities, investor-owned utilities and consumer-owned utilities alike. Section 32 is a minor change that the municipal electric utilities need so that they can calculate their in-lieu of taxes that they pay, either on gross revenue or on a volumetric basis. And Section 23 is provides two exemptions to the Public Records Act, protecting our personal, when I say our, the PUDs and the munis only, protecting personal customer information and protecting sensitive business information. We found that these two changes are necessary to protect our customers the same way that those customers of investor-owned utilities and cooperatives are already protected today. In sections 34 through 41, there's a lot of pages and a lot of text there, but basically they're just making minor modifications to existing statutes regarding joint projects that we might participate in. So I briefly reviewed the sections which pertain to the to Oregon's consumer-owned utilities. This language is the result of months of work by our members in an effort to best protect our consumers and their utilities. The statewide organizations and their members agree that if the legislature passes Senate Bill 1149 as it currently stands, each local community will have the tools and protection necessary to manage the changes that are occurring in our industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. Any questions, Ms. Cowan? To come to a conclusion in terms of your testimony, you will have some relatively minor technical amendments that we'll want to offer here in the process. But as far as the major components of Senate Bill 1149, the customer-owned utilities are comfortable with the major portions of the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we are. We've worked very hard on that language, and we are very comfortable. But like I said, we will have some amendments that we'll need to offer.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have this bill back up for public testimony next Monday at 3 o'clock in this room, I assume. At that time, those who would like to provide some additional testimony to the committee should feel free to come forth and provide that. Might not be a bad idea if you choose to do so to let committee staff know that you want to give testimony that day. You still will need to come in and sign up, but it would be helpful if committee staff knows. And if committee staff has some sense as to what you would like to testify to, and particularly if you have any proposals or sections of the bill that you're concerned about, might be helpful to let committee staff know that in advance. I would certainly appreciate that. But nonetheless, on Monday, you will have an opportunity, and I believe then the plan will be next Friday as well. We will be taking additional public testimony on Senate Bill 1149. The hope is that we'll be able to get all of the testimony in and go into work session the following week, which would be the week of the 17th, I think. 17th. But certainly we're going to make sure that everybody who wants to give testimony on this bill has an opportunity to do that and to be able to come forth with any language they might propose in terms of amendments. Yeah, Representative Montgomery.
Mr. Chairman, I've heard the phraseology quite often today and a couple days earlier that there are a lot of minor amendments coming forward, kind of like an ugly baby. Everybody likes it, but they want to change it a little bit, and I'm afraid we're going to have a major change here before it's over, so maybe if we could see the amendments as we move along, it might be very helpful.
Yeah, we'll be working on that process, Representative. I appreciate your input on that. Anything else from the committee today? Okay, if not, thank you, and we are adjourned.